Your role as a parent is to prepare your daughter to live without you, but no one can prepare you to live without them. Your heart simply aches because you miss her so much. Author of Quote Unknown. Hey y'all, what's up? It's Shay here. How's it going, Barb? How was your weekend?
I'm doing really good. I can't complain. I did a bunch of stuff, it feels like, this weekend. Went to my little cousin's birthday party and then went on a double date with Jesse. And we literally did not make it back home until like 3:30 2 days ago in the morning. And then Sunday we went to my dad's and visited him, and we were there for pretty much the whole day. But yeah, it was really good. How was your weekend?
Girl, you had a busy weekend. Shoot. But it sounded like you had fun.
Yeah, we did have fun. We went, played some darts, shoot some pool, and there was actually like a tournament going on. So that was really interesting.
Oh, nice. That's always fun to watch.
Yeah.
This weekend, I celebrated my brother's birthday. We had Chinese food upon Chinese food upon Chinese. My mom ordered so much Chinese food, I don't even know what she was thinking. So, of course, we came home with a big tray of Chinese food, and so we'll have dinner and lunch for about a day or two. And I've also just been mostly doing schoolwork. I stayed up until 3 on Friday night doing lots and lots and lots of schoolwork. So, ooh, yeah, it's going to be real fun this semester.
Well, the Chinese food sounds great, but I definitely do not miss school.
Yeah, I actually enjoy school, so it hasn't been too bad just yet. So we'll see how it goes throughout the summer. But yeah, we can't thank you all enough for your support and your love throughout our journey. We really love what we do here at Texas Chicks Who Talk Murder, and we're super excited to share all of these stories with y'all. There's not really too much business to talk about today. I think we're just going to kind of jump into the episode. But with that being said, let's get started. The information that I got was from wikipedia.org, storiesoftheunsolved.com, and then hometownbyhandlebar.com. All of these will be in our show notes, so please feel free to go to the show notes and get the information that you need. So today we will be talking about three girls that were taken from their local mall out of thin air. This story is known as the Missing Trio of Fort Worth. Barb, have you heard of this before?
Yes, I actually have. I don't remember a lot of the details on it, just because the last time I heard about it was several years ago. So I'm definitely excited and looking to refresh my memory about this case.
Yeah, awesome. I'm excited to refresh your brain. So I'm going to be going over the before and aftermath of the tragic event, and then but before we continue, I just want to let you know that this case has not been solved to this day. So please listen carefully to all of the details I share with you, and also please make sure you stay to the end and get all of the information. We want to help the family of these three girls get the closure that they deserve. So let's get into what happened on December 23rd, 1974, just 2 days before Christmas. So it was just before noon, three girls who I suspect were neighbor friends and were hanging out before they decided to go to the mall. Like, I don't think it was this pre-planned situation. It didn't say, like, I'm pretty sure the girls were not related in whatsoever, and they were just friends. The thing that gets me is they're all three, like, pretty different age groups, so it was just a little odd to me, but in 1974, I'm sure everybody was friends with everybody. Anyways, these three girls' names were Mary Rachel Terlitza. I'm sorry if I butchered that. That is not a American last name from the research that I found, but she went by Rachel. She was 17 at the time of the disappearance. There's also Julie Ann Mosley, who was 9, and Lisa Renee Wilson. She went by Renee, who was 14. I mean, this seems normal to me, almost like three sisters were shopping on just another day. it was kind of odd to me that they were just friends and they were just hanging out. I get like a 17-year-old with a 9-year-old is kind of like weird, but maybe it's like a big sister situation where she just kind of watches out for her. And either way, they all knew each other and they're all hanging out and decided to go to the mall. I know there was a 9-year-old girl, but in my opinion, I feel when there's a 17-year-old girl and a 14-year-old, I would trust them to take care of that 9-year-old. So today we say, oh, you can't go to the mall unless this person's with you. To me, I feel like that 17-year-old was that 9-year-old's person. You can't go unless this person goes. You know what I'm trying to say?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So she had that adult with her. The parents, you know, I guess trusted Rachel at the time. So as far as anyone knows, they were all together every step of the way. Before they left, Julie had to basically beg her mom to go. So Julie is the 9-year-old. Her mom first told her no, she couldn't go. Then Julie kept begging, like, of course, any child her age does when they want to get their way. But her mom would end up caving. She had a curfew of 6 p.m. that day. And the girls were actually fine with that time because it was said that they actually were planning on being home around 4 p.m. because Renee, the 14-year-old, was planning on going to a Christmas party with her boyfriend that evening and wanted to have plenty of time to get ready and all dolled up. You know how that goes. Us girls take plenty of hours to get ready for a big event like that, especially at 14. Imagine, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the three went on their way after getting permission. The first stop that the girls made was at a surplus store in Fort Worth. The girls stopped here and picked up some items that Renee had waiting there on layaway. After grabbing her items, the three would head to the Seminary South Shopping Center, which was the main place that the three wanted to go at the beginning. They just had made a pit stop real quick. They would end up parking in the Sears upper level parking lot, making their way inside. Many people say that they saw the girls shopping around the mall. The parents knew that the girls planned to be home at 4 p.m., especially the 14-year-old mom. She is like, I know how my daughter is. I know she needs this much time to get ready. So if she's not here by 4 p.m., then I'm going to probably start getting worried because I know how she is. And when they didn't return home, the parents all started growing concerned. They were like, where are these kids at? Why are they not home yet? So they gave them a little bit of time to show up, thinking maybe they were just running a little late. Things happen. You get caught up running around the mall. Their worries just grew over time. So one of the girls' parents would end up showing up to the mall at about 6 p.m. that evening. So 2 hours after they were supposed to be home, which isn't really that much time. But whenever you're like, no, they need to be home, that's a lot of time. 2 hours is a long time. It didn't for sure state whose parents went and whose parents didn't. It was kind of like just the overview of like every step of the way of what happened. Either way, they would search around for the girls, and that is when they would find that the car they were in was still there in the Sears parking lot. When finding the car, the parents saw that the shopping bags that the girls had were in the car. So it is believed that the girls were at their car at some point to either drop their bags off at the car and then kind of go back inside, or they were loading up the car when something happened, which is one of like our biggest fears. I know, Barb, we talk about it all the time, that we're always like looking around, like looking at our back seat and like locking the door as soon as we get in, then we check the back seat again. And I know that's, it's not in 1974 they didn't do that, but I'm sure a lot of women do that now.
Oh, yeah, I can totally agree with that. And I think that I could totally see a situation occurring where people approach the girls and then make them put their bags in the car, shut the doors, and then they, like, force them to load in their vehicle. So to me, that sounds like a very possible thing that could happen.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's the second situation. I think something happened when they were loading their car up. I don't think they dropped the bags off and went in.
Yeah.
But of course, you never know what happened, you know. So Knowing that the girls dropped their stuff off, the parents knew something bad happened, but the police did not suspect foul play right away, like the parents did. They would actually camp out, like the parents would actually camp out at the mall the entire night, hoping that their daughters would come back, which I would do if I had a daughter and she was, I couldn't find her and she wasn't coming home. You know, imagine yours, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'd be sleeping right next with you. Right next to you, girl.
Trust
me. But they would actually, like I said, camp out. So with all this being said, police were involved. And of course, the first thing that they suspected was that the girls ran away. They thought that a 9-year-old, a 14-year-old, and a 17-year-old girl ran away without all of the things they bought that day. Instead of using the money that they spent on all of those items to help them run away, they spent it on things at the mall and then ran away after.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, that doesn't make any sense whatsoever, because if they ran away, they would have ran away without going and buying items in the mall.
I mean, even if they did still go buy items in the mall, why would they leave them in the car?
Exactly. I mean, a 9-year-old. I could see maybe if, like, I don't know. I don't know how the girls were, but from what the family says, this is absolutely not an option. This would not have happened. But I just thought it was weird that literally the first thing they said, oh, they ran away. Well, that doesn't make any sense. Think about it before you say something.
Mm-hmm.
But the very next day, Rachel's husband, Thomas A. I can't say that name. I'm so sorry. Hold on. Let me go to my pronunciation up here. Terlitza. Okay. So, Thomas Terlitza received a letter from Rachel. So, just to kind of back up a little bit, I think I might go over it, but Rachel, the 17-year-old, did get married shortly before, I think like only 6 months before this or so. So just kind of like a quick backup real quick there.
Is that legal?
If your parents sign off. So yes, it is if you are one, emancipated, and two, your parents can sign something saying that they are allowing you to get married.
Okay, but that is ridiculous. Like, you're not even legally an adult yet, and you're going to make an adult decision and get married?
Yep.
Like, you're not even allowed to buy a pack of cigarettes.
I know, right? Yeah, well, 1974 was also probably a very different time than what we see now. We would absolutely not let our children get married at that age. But back then, you never know what was happening. You never know what the situation was.
There's still literally like people who marry and like get married off at such a young age.
Oh yeah.
And I didn't know that was like a thing in Texas. I know there's areas in the United States that you can, but that literally that still blows my mind. Like, how are you able to get married but you can't even buy a pack of cigarettes?
I know, it's crazy. Like, I guess because everybody's raised different, but still, it's just like, to us it's so like that's just not normal, but to them it's normal. It's part of their, most of the time it's part of their culture. Sometimes it's a little sketchier than that, but sometimes it's just part of their culture and that's what they do. But gonna go back to this. So her husband received a letter. There were a few things in the letter that the police and Tommy noticed right away that just didn't seem right. But according to Wikipedia, the letter said, quote, "I know I'm going to catch it, but we had to get away. We're going to Houston. See you in about a week. The car is in Sears upper lot. Love, Rachel," end quote. Which is kind of weird. It didn't make any, the first sentence says, "I know I'm going to catch it, but we had to get away." I don't know what that means. Catch what?
I don't know.
Yeah, so there's a few things, so I'm going to kind of go over this and kind of talk about why they didn't sit right. So according to the Hometown Handlebar article, one of the red flags in the top was that in the top left corner, the, I guess the name was written really oddly. It was misspelled the first time it was written. So for the Rachel, the instead of the L, it was first written as an E. And then it kind of was like erased or kind of like scratched out. And then it was written over. So it's almost like they didn't know how to spell, like she didn't know how to spell her name, but she's 17. So she's been writing it for 17 years. So it's kind of really weird to them that she did that. And it almost seems like she was being forced to write it. And maybe the stress like could have caused her to make that simple mistake. That's assuming that someone did take her and the other two girls. But that was not the only thing that was weird. Thomas was referred to with his formal name, Thomas A. Oh my God, why can I not remember that freaking name? I'm gonna say
Terlitza.
Terlitza. I don't know why I'm struggling with that. Anyway, I'm handicapping that, I guess. But it was said that Rachel only referred to her husband as Tommy. She didn't ever use Thomas or his full name or anything like that. So that was super odd to them that she would just say Thomas A. Terlitza and not Tommy. So it just was weird. Then it was said that the letter was written in pen, but the envelope was written in pencil. So I don't know what the issue is with that. Maybe the note was pre-written maybe and then signed off by her, and then like the envelope was also pre-written in a different like utensil, I guess. I don't know why they thought that was suspicious, but with these weird things that stuck out to the police with that letter, that was pretty much the three situations that kind of like pushed them back and said, okay, maybe they didn't run away because of these weird situations. So to continue with the letter, there was nothing else but a blurry zip code. It was hard for the police to officially confirm what exactly the zip code was, but it was believed that it was either 76038 to Throckmorton, Texas. And guys, I've never even heard of these towns, and I've lived in Texas my whole life. It says one of them was Throckmorton, Texas. One was Eliasville, Texas, and the other was Weatherford, Texas. There was three different zip codes that they couldn't figure out what it was. So just to kind of like give y'all a visual, Throckmorton, Texas is a little over 2 hours away from Fort Worth. Eliasville, Texas is almost a 2-hour drive from Fort Worth, and Weatherford, Texas is a 31-minute drive from Fort Worth. So they're really not that far. All of these towns are really close. And I feel like if the girls would have actually run away, there would be tips called in from people seeing them around, because word travels fast, especially 3 hours or less from where the letter was possibly sent out. Like, that doesn't make any sense that like tips wouldn't be called in for these three girls missing. So I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, even when you go back to the letter, I feel like if she did write it, misspelling her name and then correcting it and then referring to Tommy as Thomas or however, like those could be her ways of trying to get it across to the police and to her family, like they didn't run away. Like, mm-hmm. Those were like signs and signals. And if it wasn't her, then I feel like it could possibly be the person who abducted them, trying to spell her name right and then referring this guy. Like, she doesn't know what, or he or she doesn't know, like, what she calls her boyfriend.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. That's a little weird.
Yeah, I just think it's weird. Like, the letter was all weird, and even with the letter being weird, though, the police still believe that it was written by Rachel when they compared it to other letters that were written by her.
Yeah, which it could have been Rachel, but maybe
exactly.
She spelled her name wrong to get the signal across, like, okay, something's wrong. Like, yeah, I'm spelling my name wrong here on purpose. And then you like, it.
This is serious, Thomas.
Yes.
This is a serious thing. Yeah, I don't know. And the letter just didn't make any sense. So, I don't know. It's super weird. But through the years, there were multiple opinions by different investigators that took on this case. I want to share with y'all what was stated in the Hometown Handlebar article that had me thinking. It said, quote, "But consider this, the envelope stamps was canceled on the morning of December 24th, and thus the letter was written and mailed before that time. The first news account of the girl's disappearance did not appear until that Evening Star telegram. That account said that the girl's car was parked and locked on the east side of the center. And yet the writer of the letter had known that the car is in Sears upper lot. I just thought that," and that's end quote. Like, I thought that was super interesting that the letter was sent out basically before the girls were even realized were missing. And then the post was canceled.
No, that should tell you right there.
Yeah. It was, I could not, like, not share that from that article. I just thought it was super interesting. But other than the letter, there was nothing. There was nothing in the car that would help the police, and there were only witnesses who said they saw the girls at the mall during the day, and that's it. After about a week of the girls disappearing, the families would be in contact with psychics, which is super interesting. From, I didn't even get all of the psychic stuff that they went through, but it's really interesting what some of these people said. There were actually more than one, and the first one was a man that went by Dr. Joseph, and he lived in Dallas. Some of the things they were told were really interesting. One of the things that Dr. Joseph mentioned was, quote, "Dope is involved. There are 3 to 5 people involved, and the girls are being held against their will," end quote. There was also a time when Dr. Joseph mentioned that Julie was wearing red tennis shoes, and this would shock Renee's mother because she said that this was not shared with anyone, not even shared on the news. So it was really weird to her, and the fact that he knew this would just blow the parents' minds, because when you think about psychics, people are like, this is kind of sketchy, like they're just kind of making up stuff. But whenever they can pinpoint something so specific, it's like, to them, they're just like, okay, this person really kind of knows what they're talking about. But Dr. Joseph asked if 150 meant anything to Tommy. Tommy said yes, because there was $150 in bonds in the car that the 3 girls were in, or inside. But even crazier is that the $150 in bonds was not in the car when they searched the vehicle. That was just one of the psychic's beliefs on what happened to the girls. Isn't that crazy? Like,
yeah,
just saying 150, like, who would have told this psychic that there was $150 worth of bonds in the car?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that just doesn't, it's just weird. Like, because the red shoes, you could say, oh, well, maybe they saw something, like, on a piece of paper or whatever. Maybe they heard somebody talking about it or whatever. But the $150 in bonds is really weird to kind of point out. But the families would reach out to multiple psychics, like I said, and they all had something new to offer, but nothing would come out of any of them. After getting nowhere, the families hired a private investigator. This man's name was John Swam. Not even a year after the girls went missing in August, John would find out something that the police didn't. He said that there was a 28-year-old guy who worked at a store that Rachel applied to for a job. He would find that this man was using these positions to basically get women's personal information, and he would use the phone numbers given, and he would call these women randomly, and it was reported that the phone calls were really odd. Like, some of them were inappropriate, some of them weren't, some of them were just like of him breathing, like, it's super weird. Not only that, but he actually lived in the same neighborhood as Rachel until she moved. That's freaking weird. But Sadly, the suspect would end up being a dead end. Then, a little over a year after the girls went missing, three skeletons were found by an old drilling crew, but it was determined that it was not the girls, and that one was actually a male who was about 15 to 17 years old. That is just another tragedy on its own. Like, you think it's your daughter, but then you find out, oh my God, that's three more children that were basically killed that are barely being found. That's tragic.
But yes, it is.
Yeah. And then these parents just went through, oh, this is this. Nope. Oh, this is this. Nope. Like, all of their leads are just dropping every single time they find one. This would lead them to yet another dead end. Then in 1979, John would actually pass due to what was believed to be an overdose that would actually be ruled as a suicide. But that's not it, because before he died, it was ordered that every single one of his case files be destroyed if he were to ever die. Which is really weird. Like, he wanted all of this stuff that he was working on was basically destroyed after he overdosed.
What?
Yeah, really, really weird. But this didn't stop them from looking for the girls. In 1981, remains were found but determined not to be any of the remains of the girls. Then in 2001, a new investigator would release that he believed the girls willingly went with someone they knew but wasn't expecting anything bad to happen. He thinks they went with someone they trusted. Then in 2018, two cars were lifted from Benbrook Lake. It was thought that the cars are connected to the case, but to this day, there has been no evidence of them being connected. To this day, the girls seem to have just vanished off of the face of Earth. I just want to mention that this was just a quick rundown of their case. There is so much more information to be told, but the most important things was sharing this case with y'all, giving y'all some information, and letting y'all get the word out for these families and helping them. But with that being said, what are your thoughts on this case, Barb?
Obviously, like, the information that police have, there probably is more than what we can see and learn about online and on the internet. So I could see maybe he thinks that they knew him for reasons that are unknown to us. But just based off of what you told us today on today's podcast, I really think that they may have approached the vehicle to get into the car to leave and were bombarded by more than one person and basically forced to put the bags in the car to make it look like maybe they just ran away, and then forced into a vehicle, and then something bad happened along the way, such as sex trafficking. Because a lot of times when people go missing and they're still alive, it's because they're trafficked and are never seen again, unfortunately.
Yeah. I totally agree. And especially in the 70s, I'm sure sex trafficking was insane because of everything else that the police were dealing with. But yeah, I think this case is super tragic, in the fact that, like, the families had to go up and down and up, like, all of their leads would just drop right away. Like, it's so sad to see. But I think this is super important. I know this episode's a little bit longer, but I think it's really important that before we finish, I want to end with giving you all a description of the three girls. Mary, or I guess I should say Rachel, because that's how I've been referring to her. Rachel, who would be about 65 today, at the time of her disappearance, she was a Caucasian female who was 5'6" and about 108 pounds. She had long brown hair, green eyes, a chipped upper front tooth, and a scar on her chin. She was also married and was wearing her wedding ring on the day she disappeared. Lisa Renee Wilson would be about 62 years old today. She was a fair-skinned Caucasian female. She was about 5'2" and 110 pounds at the time of her disappearance. She had wavy light brown hair, brown eyes, and a scar on the inside of one of her thighs. She was also wearing a promise ring that was given to her by her boyfriend that she was supposed to be going to the Christmas party with. Julie Ann Mosley would be about 57 today. She is a Caucasian female who was about 4'3" and 85 pounds at the time of her disappearance. She had shoulder-length sandy blonde hair and blue eyes. She also had a scar under her left eye, another on the middle of her forehead, and another on her back calf. I got all of the descriptions directly from Wikipedia, by the way, just so you guys know. But that concludes today's episode. Thank you all for joining us, and please feel free to reach out to Barb or myself at tcwtm2021@gmail.com. Message us on Instagram at Texas Chicks Who Talk Murder with no spaces, Twitter at Texas Chicks Who with the number one, Facebook at Texas Chicks Who Talk Murder. We are also asking that you guys take a minute of your time and give us a review on whichever platform you are using. This will help us reach a larger audience. Also, please share these stories to your friends and family. And last but not least, stay out of dark places and watch your back, because you never know who's lurking. Bye.
Bye.